Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project.
You are listening to the McCarthy Project live from Minnesota, where we have been attacking life and sports since 2001.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project, where we have been attacking life and sports since 2001. Today, we are going to be talking, actually, we're going to be announcing some pretty cool things that are going to be happening in Minneapolis this weekend. I take that back, not this weekend. June 21st through the 23rd, Jack Brewer is putting on some really cool stuff related to concussions and the NFL and sports. And so we taped the interview yesterday with him. And so we're going to be airing that interview today. And then as well, we'll be having Sean Goodsell come on the show to be talking about how to coach an unmotivated athlete. So that's going to be our show for today. Thank you all, everybody, for coming. I look forward to kind of sharing with you Jack Brewer information. I look forward to talking with Sean. So with that, we are going to snap off by Thistle. And if you are interested in getting a hold of the CD, it's imthistle.com. That's T-H-I-S-L.com. I think it's a fantastic song. We will go ahead and play this snap off.
When that beat drop, boy, I'm about to snap off. When that beat drop, boy, I'm about to snap off. When that beat drop, boy, I'm about to snap off. Snap off, snap off, I'm about to snap off. When that beat drop, boy, I'm about to snap off. When that beat drop, boy, I'm about to snap off. When that beat drop, boy, I'm about to snap off. Snap off, snap off, I'm about to snap off. I ain't got nothing to lose, I already done lost it. You see the life that I live now, but you don't know what this thing cost me. I rapped about what I lived about, you better go and do your homework. When that whistle blow, when that ball snap, I'm cross the line and I'm in first. My team though, they home. When it's time for us to roll out, boy, we come together, we home. Through blood, sweat, and tears, boy, but we do not lose. We hold it down this front line like an O-line in the Super Bowl. When it's game time, it's crunch time. Fuel us with them backers. Hello to all my haters, sorry, but I see you later. Hope that you can see the table. My Lord just said a place for me, and I'm sitting down and I'm going to eat. I black out, I zone out, do all that till I'm on E. I snap off, snap off.
Hands up, hands banging.
Well, good morning. This is Stephen McCarthy, your host of the McCarthy Project. And we are going to switch up the order just a little bit from what I just announced. Originally, the plan was to play Jack at first, but unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, we're going to move over to Sean Goodsell first, and then we'll come back and air the taped interview that I did with Jack yesterday. So I have Sean Goodsell on the phone, or on the show today, and we are going to be talking about the unmotivated athletes. And I think at a youth level, for sure, you know, but I'm sure as Elon moves up through college and pros, there always seems to be the athlete that is either causing problems or seems to be unmotivated in some way. So it really is a big subject in the world of coaching as far as how do you change that motivation to become positive rather than a negative influence. And as all of our listeners know, Sean Goodsell has done this for a long time, 10, 15 years, worked with coaches and athletes, and has some really simple, very timely advice related to working with these types of athletes. And I think you'll be surprised because we've already talked with it a little bit off air. And all this is going to take is a little bit of work on the coach's part to get there. So, Sean, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Stephen. It's another Friday, and it's another opportunity to hopefully, as we would say, bring the wood to the listeners. So I'm, as always, excited to talk about the topic at hand.
Exactly. And it's funny because the more I listen to other podcasts and listen to what people are talking about, I think you said it more appropriately. I think people nowadays are looking for the what. I just don't think that they're interested in the fluff anymore.
No, I think people are at a point in their life, whether it's personally or parenting or coaching, that, number one, they don't have the time to be entertained by the fluff. They really just want to know what works and how do I take a challenging situation and how do I turn it into a success. And, you know, if you look at your own life, and I look at my life, and I have the things that I'm trying to grow and get better at, I don't have time to listen to something that doesn't work. You know, I only have time to listen to and explore and experiment with things that have worked in the past so that they give me a sense of credibility and trust that I can change or create a new solution with the problem that I have right now.
It's funny because, and I'm going to tie in the Jack Brewer thing, because even we talked about that last night, is that there are literally hundreds of different, you know, either media or the internet or your phone trying to buy for your mental energy. And if you are not focused on the right things, you could be spending lots of time doing essentially nothing. And I think that is the biggest key to even the subject at hand, is that so many people want to say they're in such a hurry that they show up to their, you know, they volunteered to coach or they're the high-level coach. They're so busy, they got so many things on the plate that they don't want to take the time with the unmotivated athlete, and they just blow them off as they're a loser, they're unmotivated, whatever the excuse they want to give. But they really don't invest the time in that athlete and therefore don't get the response that they're looking for. And then it just kind of becomes that cycle, that big drift downhill to nowhere.
Well, most of the time when we churn our wheels or, you know, nowhere in life, it's either because we have a bad strategy or because we have interpreted our problem in an incorrect fashion. So, for instance, if we want to dive a little bit into this topic, oftentimes, when a coach experiences somebody who's unmotivated, the first interpretation of a lack of motivation is that this athlete is lazy. Like there's something wrong in their character. They don't have good work ethic. They are looking for an easy way out. They are character flawed in some fashion. So the intervention is oftentimes something that is dictatorial, or it's using a kind of force or using manipulation or power to try to get somebody who's, in their mind, lazy to now engage and care about what the coach wants them to do.
It's funny because a lot of it still, it's funny because it comes back even to this world of the coach is important, but shouldn't be in front. You know what I mean? So much comes down and is responsible on the coach to put the effort in to engage, and but yet he can't be the one out there saying, I did it, I did it, I did it, you know, so to speak.
Well, Stephen, remember this. All of us have the capacity to be unmotivated. It's not like a lack of motivation is something that every one of us haven't experienced before. And we don't have to go too far in our lives to remember a time when something was asked of us that we had a hard time finding the motivation to do. I mean, if you just talk to people in your neighborhood, if you ask how many of them actually work out on a regular basis, every one of them will say, yeah, well, I kind of need to work out, but I don't have a whole lot of motivation to do that. Or, you know, the various responsibilities that are required of us to just live a very balanced life, most of us don't have the motivation to do most of what we need to do in order to live a great life. So we shouldn't take a position of superiority around those that are unmotivated, because that would say that all of us have mastered the art of motivation, and that's just simply not the fact.
True. I mean, that's true. You don't really process the information that way. You're always just thinking, well, you're right and everybody else is wrong. You know what I mean? And you go into the situation and you see somebody that, you know, I can already see it as young dad, as young coaches, you know, coaching basketball for the first time. And you show up ready to instill everything you've learned and more about basketball, and you have the ultimate motivation to win the house championship, and you got four players that are just giving you the look, like with a big smile, and they say, you know what, I'm just here because my mom and dad signed me up. You know what? And what are you going to do when all of a sudden you bring the wood with them, and they're all just standing there going, I don't care. I just assumed sit there and play with my buddies while we're in the middle of practice. You know?
Yeah, I just wanted to have fun today. I didn't want to work hard at anything. Are you kidding me? I worked hard yesterday in school, and you want me now to care about this? So I think,
I want to go one other place, because let's just talk to lay the groundwork, because I think there is the unmotivated athlete at every level, like I did on the intro, but it might change. Like, we just talked about the house, you know, athlete, if you will, and there's the college athlete, and there's the pro athlete. Each one of those has different sets of circumstances. And maybe not coaching the same way, would you agree?
Ask that question again. I didn't understand it completely.
Well, how would you coach differently at each level of house, and we'll say house, high school, college, and pro? Because every one of those is different people and might have different circumstances and are different people. You can't coach the same way at all levels.
From an actual what you do perspective, you have to adjust to the athlete or the audience that you're coaching. So you're right in that fashion. But at every level, if you're going to generate success, you have to know how to unlock the motivation within the people you're coaching. And so the philosophy is the same between all groups, but the actual practice or the actual action that you take to generate or to unlock the motivation is different based on the age group of person that you're working with.
Can you give us more information?
What's that?
Kind of develop that out for us, because I think when you talk about the different pieces of motivation, how is that motivation applicable? How do you get it to make sense for the athlete that doesn't care?
Well, first of all, let's understand motivation, first of all, because if you don't understand motivation, then you don't really know what actions to take. So let me start by defining the different types of motivation. every human being has two types of motivation. First one is what's known as extrinsic motivation, and that is the energy that is generated because of a reward that is usually either instantaneous or something that is felt, you know, as a reward. So if I, you know, I hear of parents all the time trying to motivate their kids to do well in school by paying them money. Well, that's an extrinsic motivator, or winning a championship is an extrinsic motivator. And extrinsic motivation is something that is short-lived. It lasts for a very short period of time, and it's not something that can sustain the rigors and long-term efforts that are needed to succeed at a high level. So if athletes are primarily motivated extrinsically, there's going to be a scarcity of energy at different times with moments of high levels of energy but can't be sustained. Intrinsic motivation is the motivation that is generated from within yourself. It answers the question at a deep level, why do you do this? Why do you want to play basketball, or why do you want to make the A team, or why do you want to play in college? And sometimes there's a nice mix between extrinsic motivators and intrinsic motivators, but where intrinsic motivation is weak, long-term motivation will be limited. Okay, so where intrinsic motivation is weak, long-term energy and motivation will be limited. So a coach has to be able to tie in the activities and the goals that they have for their team, whether it's at the house league level or at the pro level, has to be able to tie in to both the intrinsic and extrinsic motivators of the athlete. Otherwise, motivation will be challenged, limited, and or non-existent altogether.
Can you give us an example? You know, because I'd like to really flesh out, because it seems like a lot of times when you're giving the answers is that it really is very simple. That's all. That makes sense. But how does it actually look in real life?
So give me a situation, and I'll give you an example.
Perfect. Okay, let's start off with like the first example that I gave. You're in house basketball. You're a dad. You're really motivated to show everybody in the community that you're a great basketball coach and you want to win the house championship. But you have a couple athletes that are only interested in playing basketball because their mom signed them up. So you're looking at Johnny, and he's, in your mind, space cadetting all the time and not really paying attention. Doesn't do the drill right, you know, doesn't run the play sometimes because he hasn't been paying attention, you know, all this kind of stuff. What would you do with somebody like that?
Well, first of all, if a coach is going into a house league situation and their primary motivator is to win a championship, then they have no chance of generating motivation in the unmotivated athlete. So I would fire the coach. That would be the first thing I would do.
But it's volunteer, volunteer.
Well, then I would let them go of their volunteer opportunity. We can make light of this, but here's why. If the coach's agenda is winning and they're there to prove something to the community about their competencies as coaches, as revealed in their ability to win, either they have to sell all of their athletes on how important it will be for them to show how good of a coach they have by winning, or they're going to have to sell the athlete on something that matters to them in order to engage them in the developmental process so that they will care enough about winning to do the things that the coach asks them to do. So your example is actually a really good one, because I think a lot of coaches go into their volunteer experiences with their house league team and they get why they're there mixed up, and they don't take the time to unlock the motivation for why the kid is there. So, for instance, this is what I would do if I was that house league coach. The first practice, I'd take 15 minutes, and I'd say, my name is Sean Goodsell. I'm here because I love coaching basketball, and I'm hoping to make basketball something that you enjoy. Then I would pass it to the player, and I'd say, who are you? Why are you here? My name is Stephen McCarthy. I'm here because I don't have anything better to do on this night, and my parents want to go on a date, and I'm here just to kill some time. Great. Thanks for being here tonight, Stephen. Next one. My name is Jim Jones, and I'm here because I really love basketball, and I want to become a better basketball player, and I want to win every game. Great. Thanks for being here tonight, Jim. And you go around the room, go around the gym, and you find out why people are there, because you need that information if you're going to generate an experience that gives that kid a reason to engage. Does that help?
Yes. You know, and how do you, in that world when you have the Stephen McCarthy's of the world that literally are being dropped off, and that's as far as it goes, how would you, over the span of the season, then try to integrate him into a team that would play as a team and would learn the foundational skills of being a basketball player?
It's a good question. I would say, remember how in one of our first conversations a while back I said that as a coach, one of the first things you got to get figured out is what an amazing opportunity it is to be to build into and mentor the lives of the people that show up on your team. And if Stephen McCarthy, in the way that I described him in the example, showed up on my team, the first thing that I would have to get straight is that I don't care why Stephen's here, Stephen's here. And it's my pleasure and my honor to have him on my team. And it's my responsibility and my challenge to give him a reason to love coming to basketball. And that's where the art and the ability to turn that kind of experience into success is where making sure that our youth coaches are prepared and trained for those kind of experiences, because there is no one way to do it. There is no one way to unlock the possibility of Stephen McCarthy. There's plenty of ways to ruin it, but there's no one way to do it. And the best I can tell the listener is that if you're a coach, you got to get your motivation straight. You got to make sure you understand the privilege and honor it is to have anybody show up on your team. And then after that, it's about understanding who your athletes are and finding creative ways to give them a reason to keep showing up. And for some guys, the reason to show up is that at the end of practice, you're going to bring a cooler full of Gatorades, and they're going to look forward to the Gatorade you're going to give them at the end of practice because that meant that you cared enough to bring something. So you can't get overly complicated. You can't get overly too theoretical about this. It just boils down to knowing it's a great opportunity to impact the life of a kid. You got to understand them enough to know why they should come back again, and then it's your job as a coach to create the environment where everybody's intrinsic motivators are met.
Because I'm going to just kind of go through some experiences that I've had as a youth coach, I should say. And because a situation like that, say you create that environment, and I've actually seen this done, by the way, and you create an environment, but there's that one person that's not responding because of their view of what they're doing, and they really just don't care. What would you do with the person that really just doesn't care?
Boy, that's a tough question to ask to me, because I don't believe somebody just doesn't care. I there's not too many kids that I don't believe that I could get to care. And So your question's a good one in that I know there are many coaches who run into kids who provide them a greater challenge than they have skills to work with. So on one hand, when you ask me that question, I say, Steven, there's not one kid that you could provide in my team that I couldn't get to care. Now, that may sound arrogant and overly confident, but my experience has proven that over the course of, you know, 20-some years working with kids. But for those, for the coaches who are stuck, I would say, number one, you can't give up, because a kid that doesn't care is sending messages to the world around them that they want people to give up on them. So when you give up, you're just affirming in their mind that they were worthy of giving up on. And number two, I would make sure that every time I was with that kid, I noticed and I spoke out loud something I liked and saw that I liked in that kid, even if the 25 things that show themselves most obvious were things I didn't like, I would find the one thing I did and I would make a celebration out of it. And the third thing that I would do is involve them in small ways that didn't require a ton of effort, but required some effort. And I would just keep making bids over and over and over again to try to get them to take steps towards greater levels of involvement. But I think my major strategy would be to find things that I saw that I liked and accentuate them in any way I possibly could, and I would just make a practice of that on a regular basis.
So ultimately, that young person is looking for attention.
That young person, Stephen, believes that there's nothing good about them. And that young person is in an environment most likely where they are told on a regular basis how they're not measuring up, how they're failing, how they're disappointing somebody. And they've just got to the point where they realize it's not worth even trying anymore, because the best in me doesn't seem to come out. Therefore, it's not noticed and it's not accentuated. So why should I care?
Because ultimately, then, what you're saying is that you must persist the same way you would in business. If something's not going right, you mold it, you create it until it has started to turn, and then you will start to see it. But you can't just blow it off and say, well, they're not worthy of my investment, so to speak.
A lot of those unmotivated kids are champions in the making. It's just that they provide a really tough initial experience. But once you win over and once you change the direction of that person's life, they will be indebted to you forever. Those are the kind of people that I think are the miracles that are waiting to happen. And as coaches, when we are not equipped, either internally, emotionally ourselves, or strategically with ideas for how to tap into a kid's life like that, when we're not equipped, we're really missing out on opportunities to change a life forever. And so that's why I've worked with some of the toughest kids that there are. I mean, I've worked with kids that are in gangs. I've worked with kids that are so depressed they can never get out of bed in the morning. And I'm not saying that it hasn't taken some time on occasion, but I haven't yet met a kid that I couldn't reach.
Amazing. So now let's switch over, because I think I'm going to move over to the high school level, because I'm going to give you another influence of a parent and how it translates into an unmotivated athlete. And I think I would really love to hear your thoughts, because in high school sports nowadays, when you get to the high school level, now you as a parent have to move to the semi-back, if you will, and allow your athlete or your son or daughter to move to the fore. But on the other hand, you watch what the coach is doing, who's playing, who's doing this, who's doing that, and you instill all these thoughts in an athlete. And you go do this, you go do that, that's not right, that's wrong, he's a loser, and you're basically implanting all these thoughts into an athlete rather than just enjoying the process, if you will.
Yeah.
And then it shows on the in when the athlete shows up because they're thinking all these random negative thoughts and are not interested. How would you deal with a situation like that?
So are you asking me how would I deal with a situation as a parent or as a coach related to the situation that you just described?
Let's do both. So let's start off with the parent.
Well, as a coach, if I had a parent that was negatively influencing an athlete I was coaching, the first thing that I would do was set up a one-on-one meeting with the athlete and describe what I was seeing in their play and ask them what they believed was the reason behind their unfocused or play that was representative of their internal challenges. And I'd see if they could correlate their lack of clarity or lack of focus to the involvement of their own parent. If they couldn't, then I would say, probably, can I give you some thoughts as to why I think this is a struggle for you? And then I'd just say, it looks to me like you are playing from two different playbooks, one that you are getting from your parent and one that you're getting from me. And I think you're going to have to choose what playbook you want to play from. If you want to play from your parent's playbook, you should probably not be on the team. And if you want to play from my playbook, then get on my playbook. But you can't play out of two playbooks. As a parent, the parenting is hard because most parents they're not even aware of the fact that they are generating that level of confusion and lack of loyalty to the coach. And the intervention with the parent is a lot more difficult because most parents aren't even aware that they are in the way of their own kid's performance. So the ability to create an awareness of what the parent is doing is a really tough conversation, which requires what I think would be some professional coaching, because most parents don't know how to do this on their own. But it's a tough one. I mean, I know that many coaches deal with that challenge. And as such, many coaches could benefit from some help about how to have conversations with parents.
And it's funny because, the simplicity of your information is simply get out on the table what you see. You know what I mean? It doesn't need to be again, this insinuation that every parent is less than a human because they want to talk to the coach about what's happening with their kids. So these coaches put these steel walls up around themselves, you know, and then they allow the athlete to come inside the steel wall and then they send them back out. But they don't create that communication when a problem arises. They just blow it off like, oh, it's just another one of those parents, if you will.
Right.
Who is the ultimate, is there, in the world today, if you are a high school coach, who do you feel has the most responsibility to create that level of communication at a good, positive level, not just listening to a parent download all the time?
So who is responsible to create a positive communication loop? Is that what you're asking?
Exactly.
The coaches. No doubt about it.
And see, that you see what I'm saying? Where there's so many high school coaches that have created that steel wall, you know, of you can't talk to me about anything, and if you do, you get penalized.
Well, here's what most coaches don't understand. Number one, they don't understand the systems nature of their job. In other words, they think that they're just coaching the kid. What they don't realize is they are involved now with a family. So if you have 18 kids on your team, you're involved with 18 families. And your actions, both positively and negatively impact the family of those that you're coaching. And if you don't start with the understanding that you are impacting 18 families, 18 families have invested up to thousands of dollars to train and help their kids excel at the experience that they are now in. 18 families have expectations of what will happen. 18 families have their own ideas about what they see and the perceptions that they generate. And 18 families are forming opinions about the quality of coaching based on hundreds of different bite-sized experiences and moments. And if the coach doesn't understand that, whether they like it or not, they are a part of generating the very challenges that their parents give them by not keeping an open line of communication with parents, then that's why many coaches are struggling right now.
And it's interesting because it's almost, is it a lack of training on a coach's position? Is it, again, they don't have enough time to invest? Is it too overwhelming? What do you feel, or is it all a combination of all those things at the coaching level?
Well, number one, I think maybe 1% of the parents in youth sports have shaped the perception of the other 99%. And so what's on the news is always the crazy, crazy parent that's going to incredible extremes. And I know, I've been involved in the youth sports world for many, 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 many years. I know that there are parents who act in very dysfunctional, crazy-making ways. However, and I put however in there because if we allow the 1% to shape the rituals, routines, and habits that affect the 99%, now we are catering to the 1% and we're robbing 99%. And I don't think coaches, number one, understand the systematic nature of their coaching actions, number one. Number two, I don't think they're trained in how to eliminate most of the interference that gets generated from parents through their own actions. And number three, once they have a very difficult parent, I don't think they're trained on how to deal with that person. So it puts coaches who are really only looking to coach and develop players in a tough spot because they don't realize that they are actually coaching families, and the player that they're coaching is the main player of the drama that's going to play out over the year.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned the bite-sized pieces, and I'm just thinking of my experiences over the time that I've coached. And really, yeah, it does come down to this because, and you might say something, like I had an experience 5-6 years ago of saying the athlete was having a difficult day on the court, shot wasn't going down. I said, please don't shoot, drive the ball. Well, the athlete only heard, please don't shoot. Well, then
Right. Immediately
following, I had a mom the next practice wanting to talk to me. I went over and talked with her, and she said, well, Johnny was crushed. He was crying. He was told that he couldn't shoot. You know what I mean? And really the intention was I wanted him to create a successful pattern by going in and shooting a shorter shot, not these longer, you know, attempts.
Right.
Is this a common theme? Did the communication become the only solution, or was there a different way to communicate it? I mean, I guess it could have been both.
Well, first of all, as coaches, we all make mistakes. I mean, I've been a professional coach for well over a decade, and I make mistakes just about every day in what I intend to say versus what I say. And so I don't think that I'm perfect. I don't think that I don't make mistakes. And therefore, it's important for me to keep a line of communication open with the parents of my clients, because whether I said it wrong or they heard it in a skewed way doesn't change their reaction and their response to what happened. So I have to maintain, and I love to maintain, an open relationship with parents because they're part of my team. they're part of the team of people that are helping me create the outcome in their kids that they're paying me to help initiate. Same with coaches, you know, if we take basketball coaches, they're part of a team. Part of their team, whether they like it or not, is the parent. And if they don't learn how to access and work with the parent, then they're going to end up unintentionally working against the parent. So so you see that a lot of the challenges that many coaches face really start with how they see themselves, how they see their role, and then how they deal with challenges that they experience coming up throughout the course of the year. And if they manage those three things well, they eliminate probably 80% of the interference that they have in any given year.
If you think about it, I'm sure a coach would love to eliminate 80% of the interference that he's dealing with.
Well, they have to believe at the start that they were responsible for 80% of it. And and most coaches
I laugh because that's funny to me.
Well, it is funny because if you talk to most coaches about what their biggest challenge for coaching is, they'll tell you parents. And if I say, how much of that problem that you experience as a challenge are you responsible for? They look back at me like, well, nothing. I don't do anything. You know, it's like somehow their impact is neutral, but everybody else's impact is important. So I find that a little bit funny as well.
Well, it's funny because I laugh because you can relate so much if you've been a coach for a while, you know, and
yeah.
And you keep thinking, why in the world does this keep happening to me? Or, you know, I get these parents all the time, or all these kind of things that you think are just everybody else's fault but your own, you know, and
right.
And so I'm relating as well as I'm laughing because I can only imagine if we had the coaches come up and say, okay, I'm 80% responsible for what's going on. Okay, I admit to it. They would never do that. It's almost like the unwritten rule that you don't admit that you made a mistake, so to speak.
I wish coaches would just at least humble themselves enough to believe that one of the first things they should ask themselves when they experience something they don't like, the first question they should ask themselves is, how did I contribute to this? You know, if you said to me, Sean, what's one thing a coach can do to increase their influence, to eliminate unnecessary interference, and to have a greater impact in families and in players they coach, I would tell you the first question you should always ask is, how did I contribute to this? And if you can, with integrity, reflect on that question, then you will eliminate a lot of negative experiences that really you'll find out started with you as a coach. And if you go into a parent communication, you say, you know, I understand that you want to have more playing time for Johnny, and I know you're upset that I haven't given Johnny more playing time, and I want you to know how I contributed to that expectation of yours and why you're upset. You'd have to be really emotionally sick to attack a coach that comes at it like that.
It makes total sense. And then that open communication, because if you're a good coach, you do understand that some people get more or less. There's not this equal opportunity to all. And the kids understand it, if somebody's better or not, so they're willing to be okay with it. But if you give a parent, these are the reasons why, you know, and whether you discuss them out, you should be confident enough in your decisions that you don't have to sit there and go into a big circle of feeding everybody lines about how, don't come past my steel wall, this is my idea, or either that or you guys can quit. You know, there's really these drawing a line in the sand type of idea.
If you're proactive as a coach and you've generated a role for every one of your players on your bench and you know how to utilize them and communicate that role to them, then you should never be lost for what to say to a parent. So I have Sean Goodsell, who's a basketball player, who's really good. He's a defensive specialist. He doesn't shoot the ball very well. He's quick, but he can't dribble the way he needs to, and he doesn't get his shot off quick enough. So my role is I'm going to try to shut down one of their top players. But it might be that in a given game, the top player that I have to guard is quicker than I am. So I don't get to play as much. And the parent calls the coach and says, why didn't Sean get to play as much tonight? The coach should be able to right away say, the guy that I usually have him guard was quicker than he was. It's not going to be something that lasts forever. It was just in tonight's game because the matchups worked better for JoJo to guard that guy than Sean. And I appreciate you asking me about that so I could explain to you why it is that why it is Sean had limited playing time tonight.
Should be good then. It's like, yes, understood. I would do that if I was in my work and I knew that there was somebody better than me for a particular task, ask the other person to do the task and come back out and the next day it's all good.
And you got to explain that to Sean. I mean, ideally, Sean should be able to explain it to his parents if the coach has a good enough relationship with Sean so Sean can explain it to his parents. Then you can avoid the conversation with the parents because you've communicated clearly to the athlete. But if there's a mix-up in the communication between the athlete and the coach, then it's going to accentuate the frustration with the parent, and it's going to make that conversation even more difficult.
All right, I have. We're going to do because I really want to get to the pro level, because I think it really brings a whole another level of motivation, if you will. But
yeah.
I do have in a particular situation here, say you are a coach and you have not been very good at these communication channels, if you will. So you're in a difficult spot. What are the couple top things you would do to start the process of healing in the appropriate way?
Great question. Are we going to talk about that now or after a break?
We'll go after a break because, I mean, it probably is a longer discussion. Perfect. I'm good with that. So
all right,
we'll go after a break and then come back and talk about how to a little bit.
They thought they was going to kill me with all their hate. Let them hoes blow, baby. You can hate me all you want to, cuz.
Can't
it's only
going
to make me
perfect.
Stronger.
Perfect.
Oh, they you can't stop this, dog. You can't stop this. It's God's plan. And I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm free now.
I'm ready.
I got my mind right.
I'm ready.
The heat out on your boy, and they left me for dead.
Oh,
blood in my eyes, thorns on my head. Only thing that I can hear is what my Savior say. While I'm in my own blood, and I can't feel my legs. But I'ma live, I'ma live. I will not die. Got up off the ground, and I wiped that blood up out my eyes. Got my mind right, got my grind right. Stood up, now it's time to rise. Been resurrected,
resurrected.
I am alive. Blood drip, headed for war. Fire in my eyes. Ready for war, no turn back. I got my dogs with me, 300 of us. Young Leonidas, take on the whole city. We don't retreat, we do not quit. We are not the same to live and die for the truth. Let's be plain, this is why I came. And if I were you, then dog, I'd probably hate me too. But the power that I come in is too big for you. So stop, so stop it for me before you go too far. My mind right, the time right, war, and I'm ready for war.
Head to the sky, my war goes on.
Alrighty, we are back. This is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project, and I am with Sean Goodsell. And it's interesting that we play this song, I'm Ready, because I think a lot of parents and coaches would actually look at this as war. You know, they have an all-out, you know, war against the coach. The coach has erected the castle in which he sits at the top and basically dictates like a king. And they are literally at war. And not in a positive, like, I'm ready is about a positive war where you need to be ready for things and to be active and to be out in the war. And I think so much of what we're talking about today is literally if people would take the emotion out of it and sit down and have a conversation, you know, and implement some of the things that Sean's mentioned, the teams would be so much better. Performance would increase just, I would almost say like by magic, but it's not by magic. And so I had posed the question at the end of the last segment about what are some how-tos. But Sean, before we go there, I want to talk about the pro athlete or that level of coaching as well. Would you rather do the how-tos after or before the pro?
After.
Okay. So let's talk about the pro athlete, you know, that has his posse and his agent and his financial advisor, because now he's got a boatload of cash. And everybody and their mother tells him that he's the king, you know what I mean? And therefore now he has to listen to this coach tell him to do something he doesn't feel that he's good at, because he's just not aware. And we hear about like the guys like Chuck Daly and Phil Jackson that are these ultimate, you know, understanding of people, and they put them in the right spot to succeed, and then if they listen. Talk to us a little about those kind of motivations.
Can you ask that question again? Not the whole thing,
sure.
Just the end part.
How would you work with a person like Phil Jackson? We'll just say you're Phil Jackson. You've got Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, Meta World Peace, you know, all these athletes that have been studs their whole life, and now you're going to put them on one team, and now they've got six people behind them telling them that they should be doing X, Y, Z, and if they don't, the coach is wrong.
So what is your question to me?
So what would you do in those situations when you're now dealing with agents and their buddies that have hung around them for 10 years and they're telling them that that's wrong, they should be doing this rather than that. So now you get those same external voices into an adult. How do you deal with an adult when he has external voices? Because it's not just a parent behind. Now it's actually there is no parent behind. It's just that you got this posse behind giving the information.
Well, first of all, when you're talking about professional athletes, you're talking about a whole different realm of person and athlete. And as a coach, you have one job and one job only, and that is to, number one, you gotta understand the player that you are coaching, and you have to understand them at a very deep level. The reason why Phil Jackson is such a great coach, especially with coaching lots of egos around him, is because he knows how to filter out what isn't important and accentuate what is. And for instance, like a coach that wants to call a star athlete out in the media, you better have a great relationship with that athlete, because in pro sports, coaches are not the most important person on the team. Athletes are. And if you're going to get rid of somebody, you're going to get rid of the coach, not the athlete. And so the coaches that last in pro sports are the ones that understand how to relate to while not caretaking to the athletes that are going to be most influential and powerful in generating wins. Because in pro sports, it's not about development. It's about wins. And you need to make sure that you are working well with your star players, because if you're not, you're not going to win, period. And you got to be creative around challenging them. You got to be creative around listening to them. And probably the most important thing that you would hear from a pro coach coaching a lot of egos is the playing field isn't equal. Kobe Bryant doesn't have to do what the bench player has to do. The bench player has to do everything. Kobe Bryant pretty much can pick and choose what he wants to do. And in a system that believes that things should be fair, that won't work because it's not going to be fair. So if I organize my thoughts, the first thing I would say is if you're a coach of a pro, a group of pros, you have to identify who your players are that are going to give you and generate your wins. You have to work effectively with those players. You have to see if you can gain their loyalty and their buy-in to what you're trying to accomplish. And you have to make sure that you protect them when they're struggling, because if you don't protect them, they'll turn on you when it's all said and done.
Is that a complex situation, or is it just more of after you sit down and really think about what you said and try to implement it? Is that a very complex, difficult task, or is it something that you just need to be aware of so that you manage it?
Well, I think every team is different because every ego that's on your team is differently wired.
Okay.
So the reason why pro sport coaches command the kind of income that they do is because you have to be pretty skilled socially. You have to be a pretty skilled X's and O's guy. You have to be pretty clear on what it is you're trying to build, and you have to be tenacious around getting rid of anything that's getting in your way of doing it. And that's why general managers, I think, are really important in pro sports, because general managers are the ones that are usually bringing in the talent that the coach is going to have to coach. So the complexity of the organization is much more advanced in a pro sport team than what we've talked about in some of these other arenas of sport.
Because you think about like the San Antonio Spurs, you know, they've been winning for 15 years. They've drafted, you know, at the end of the first round. You know, you just look at them and you say, well, how are they able to continue to do this at a high level? The coach has been the same. The general manager has been the same. But they, you know, the question I have is that you look at them and say, okay, you have the right mixture or the right recipe, let's just say. Well, when you draft players and you bring them in, do you change the recipe to match the players, or are you looking for players that match the recipe?
I think it's probably a little of both, but I think it starts with the recipe. For instance, it's not hard to build a championship team around Tony Parker and Tim Duncan, because Tim Duncan is the consummate professional. I mean, he doesn't change day in and day out. He's been a consistent performer for years. You know, you got Ginobili in there who has developed as well, but they know what they're looking for. And they know what it takes to complement the players that they have, and that's their recipe. You know, they're not looking. If you look at the San Antonio Spurs, they have built their team through the draft and through developing their players. If you look at Miami, they've bought their team, and it's not that one recipe is right and one recipe is wrong. It's just that you got to have a recipe. And if Dwayne Wade wasn't on the Miami Heat, LeBron James wouldn't be on the Miami Heat. And if LeBron James wasn't on the Miami Heat, Chris Bosh wouldn't be on the Miami Heat. So you got this Rolodex that resulted from the influence of one player on your team that you, by the way, did grow, because that's your player. But your recipe was to add other ingredients by buying them, whereas in San Antonio, their recipe is to build and develop and maximize the players they have based on a recipe of the way they want to play, with Popovich, who's been the Zen master, if you will, of that recipe.
Because that's interesting when you get down to it, because each one of those coaches then would approach the unmotivated athlete in a different way, but does get the same results. Like you think of like a Mike Miller on the Miami Heat. He doesn't play, and then he comes through when he's needed. You know, but he has to be willing to accept because Mike Miller's been all everything for 10 years. You know, he was
right.
You know, big in high school, big in college. You know, when he came out, he was drafted high. You know, played for the, I mean, so each approach but yet has the same challenges, but yet one is not better than the other.
No, not the recipe that one decides to be loyal to is defined and ultimately determined by the level of success of the execution of the recipe, not the recipe itself. I mean, mm-hmm. we can all, I have a recipe for how I can be fit in my life. And you go to the bookstore and you can find 5, 6, 10, 20 different people's ideas of how to have fitness. None of them matter unless they're executed. And they're executed with excellence. So, you know, if you look at a team like the Timberwolves, you kind of wonder what is their recipe. And you kind of wonder how good have they been at executing the recipe that they've said that they've had. Whereas you look at, you know, some other teams and you go, they have had a recipe and they've had varying levels of success in execution of that recipe. But don't get, I would just challenge people to quit being addicted to the recipe and start being fascinated and curious by the execution of the recipe from those that are involved in it.
Amazing when you think about it, because every time a new general manager comes in, we're looking for this, 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 and I'm thinking of the Timberwolves, you know, and okay, 2 years later, okay, that didn't work out. Oh, we're the next big thing. We're coming in. This is the recipe we have, you know, and it is a commentary on, are you willing to implement the recipe? Are you willing to stick with the recipe? Or are you going to just bring in what's ever cool? Or, hey, man, they told me that this is the better way to make it, you know, so we're going to try this way.
Well, and if you look at our society, we're fascinated by recipes that we don't execute. I mean, if you look at the self-help industry is a $1 billion industry. You would think, I mean, you would really think that if we were spending $1 billion on self-help, we would be better people than we are. You know, if you think about the leadership books that are written, if you think about just our society as a whole, if you think about all of the great recipes and information and paradigms and self-help and personal growth, if we were really executing on the things that are out there, we would qualify ourselves for more success, better relationships, more fulfillment, and greater levels of joy. But we live in a society that is experiencing the exact opposite of those things because we're too fascinated by the recipe and not enough by what it takes to experience the meal of the recipe.
True.
Steven, I work with parents every day who are looking for the recipe of how to be a better parent. They've read books and books and books about being a better parent. And they are not lacking effectiveness as a parent because they don't understand the book. They lack effectiveness as a parent because they won't apply the book.
Or they won't, okay, I'm going to take this recipe and apply it. Ah, it totally makes sense. Then they, look up for another, that one didn't work. I'll go find another recipe. Oh, Mike Krzyzewski, he's got a leadership book out. Oh, Bobby Knight, he's got one out. You know what I mean? And they go thing to thing to thing to thing. I totally see it.
There's really only one recipe that matters, and it's the one that you're going to use. If you compared and contrasted different philosophies, different theories, different leadership strategies, different business strategies, if you just compared and contrasted them all, they would all be in some ways very similar to each other. So why is it that we don't have more success? It's simply because we haven't disciplined ourselves to break the rituals, routines, and habits that have earned us our current results to stick with a new recipe long enough to generate the results that recipe allows us to create if we just stick with it.
All right, so that leads us right into the questions because, okay, we've correctly said, okay, you need to pick one. So you pick one. But you're in a difficult position because you have your past you're dealing with. You can't just snap your fingers and say, okay, we're doing this new recipe. Everybody get on board. You know what I mean? It just doesn't work that way. You have to essentially work your way out of the hole give us some meat as far as what we could do to say take our new recipe and now we're going to implement it when we have problems from the past.
Well, anytime you're in a position of influence where trust is a significant factor in gaining buy-in from the people that you are working with and around, the first step of getting out of any kind of hole and changing the direction of the momentum to move in a new direction, it's to acknowledge, admit, humble yourself, and name clearly the things that you believe you were a part of that contributed to the hole that you're in right now. So, in other words, if I was a high school coach and I was in the midst of a lot of parental frustration, athlete frustration, and I was losing the loyalty and the buy-in of people on a daily basis, I would call a meeting with everybody, and I would basically say, you know, I realize that many of you are untrusting, not engaged, and not very confident that the direction that we're going is helpful and or we're going to get there. And I just want to acknowledge that my lack of communication, my lack of clarity, and my inability to communicate my vision to all of you has contributed significantly to the lack of engagement you have in this program right now. And the first thing you got to do is you got to acknowledge that you participated and contributed to what isn't working in order to even have a chance of re-engaging trust with the people that you need to work with. The second thing I would do is I would try to clearly articulate next steps, and they would be over short periods of time. In other words, if I didn't have the trust and or buy-in from a group of people, I would say over the next 30 days, this is what I'm going to do in order to try to reestablish trust with every single person that I need to have it with, and I would start by conducting individual interviews with each person and with each family. And I would seek to understand where I lost it with them so I could build a repertoire of information in order to move forward with to try to help regain the trust, engagement, and buy-in of the people that I lost it with. And then after that, after you've interviewed, gotten information that's clear, then you can establish what the next 30 days looks like after that, which is these are the two things I'm going to do to overcome the objections and overcome the reason why I lost the trust to begin with. And then the last thing you got to do is you got to bring the wood. If you say you're going to do X, you got to do X. If you say you're going to do Y, you got to do Y. And if at that point you don't do X or Y, you have no legitimate reason to believe that you should gain the trust and buy-in of those people again.
Wow. Yes. You know, then I think that one of our next shows should be about something like this, how to change the direction, you know, of your organization, because there's so many questions that come out of those three or four steps that you just brought. Because say something where you do it, but you don't get the buy-in in 30 days, what are the next steps? You know what I mean? I mean, there's so many cool things that could come along in the questions of life related to it. Amazingly good
stuff.
Well,
they've done research with parenting, and they've tried to identify what are the key factors that improve parent-child communication. And many parents go into their role as a parent believing that they have to be perfect in order to maintain quality relationship with their kids. And I can tell you from personal experience that the most powerful life-changing experiences I've had with my kids is when I have gone to them and said to them, you know, I want you to know that I really messed this up. What I said to you, I didn't say in a way that truly represented my intention. Therefore, I know I hurt you, and I want you to know that I'm sorry and that I'll work really hard to never do that again. When you make repairs in relationships, the repair makes the relationship stronger than it was before the repair. And the way most parents accentuate and carry on ongoing power struggles with their kids is they don't take the time to repair the relationship when they have acted in ways that have damaged the relationship. And that's true with coaches. When you act in a way that damages the relationship with your kid or with a player you're coaching, and you don't go to that player and repair it, you have no reason to believe and no reason to expect that that player should ever respect you in a deep way again if you're not willing to repair the relationship that you broke because of your actions, attitudes, and or words.
Dude, that's all I got to say on that one. Ooh, all right.
Ooh. you think we're bringing the wood, Stephen?
Oh, my gosh. I honestly, if parents had enough kahunas to do what you just asked, amazing changes would have happened. Because what you're asking parents to do is something that they feel that they don't have to, nor were they involved. My kids were the problem, not me. And
remember the question?
Huh?
Remember the question I told people to ask themselves?
Yes.
How did I contribute to this? With my kids. My kids are acting in weird ways. Hurtful. How did I contribute to this? When you can put yourself in a responsible place of humility, you have more power with your kids than at any other time. When you are in a process of restoring your relationship with your kids, when you have been a part of destroying the relationship with your kids, when you are a part of repairing, restoring, redeeming that relationship, you are never in a more powerful state than you are at that moment.
Amazing. All right. I think we're going to leave right here. If you would like more information about this, please get a hold of Sean at mentaledgenow.com or stayinthesportzone.com. That's a video training series. I think stay in the sport zone, not plural. I learned that yesterday. But Sean is available. I mean, I think people should implement these ideas, no question about it. All right, Sean, well, we've got to move on to Jack Brewer. Thank you very much for spending the time today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you so much for what you're doing with the McCarthy Project, the opportunities you're bringing to people, and just the way you are committing yourself to growth in your own world and in your own business. It's no wonder why people love talking with you, want to be a part of your show, and thanks for making me a regular guest. It's truly my honor to serve your people.
Done. Thank you very much. Thank you. We'll talk to you next. Well, we should put a plug in. We have the Mental Edge Today, which is your show that we launched this week. If you would like more information, it's mentaledgetoday.com, and there are links to your show, which will be done on Tuesday mornings as well.
Yeah, I'm excited about our show that we're doing together. I mean, the Mental Edge Today is really designed to be a practicum or a course on how people can learn to apply the principles of mental toughness today. So if you listen to the show, you should get some teaching, some instruction on the different mental toughness principles, and then you should be able to learn how to take those ideas and apply them today so that you can truly have the mental edge today. So thanks for that. Thanks for that endorsement of the radio show.
Absolutely. All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
We're going to go to a quick break, and then we'll be back with Jack Brewer.
Five Star Basketball, the leader in basketball instruction and camps, endorsed by Michael Jordan, Dick Vitale, and Hubie Brown, and where the teaching never stops. Five Star Basketball Minnesota will be hosting a one-day instructional camp on May 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and will be hosted by Five Star, The McCarthy Project, and Grassroots Hoops. For more information on the camp, visit themccarthyproject.com/5-star. XL Athlete is the leading provider of online strength and conditioning and speed development camps. For more information on their training programs and speed development camps, visit xlathlete.com.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project. And hold on 1 second. We're going to test that one over again. Good afternoon. This is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project, and I would like to thank everybody for coming today, where we have been attacking life and sports since 2001. And today I have Jack Brewer on the show, and he is put on some very cool events here coming up in the Twin Cities in about 3 weeks, two, 3 weeks. And I asked him to come on the show to talk a little bit about his history and about how he's gone about putting these events together and his motivation, because he has a fantastic story of basically coming from a less than positive, I suppose, maybe not necessarily a positive story, but a place where there were no resources, that things maybe didn't have as much hope, and then made good and made took advantage of his opportunities and was able to grow and become in a lot of ways into these events that he's putting on. So, Jack, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Stephen. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I have to ask the question, which probably inevitably gets always asked, why would somebody from Texas come to Minnesota?
Well, that's a long story, you know. Growing up in Texas, you know, football was king. And, you know, we eat, sleep, football. And so, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, football was always my passion. You know, I loved other sports like track as well. But, you know, football was kind of inbred in me. And coming out of high school, you know, I made a bad decision and ended up, you know, passing up on the University of Miami, passing up on the University of Minnesota, Oklahoma, and several others. And I went to SMU. And it just wasn't a good decision for me. And my favorite coach during the recruiting process out of high school was always Coach Glenn Mason. He had a defensive coordinator by the name of David Gibbs, who were two inspirations to me. And I really, you know, in my heart of hearts, wanted to join those guys. And so, you know, after 1 year at SMU, I had a good freshman season. I was a freshman All-American candidate, but the football, you know, just wasn't, you know, what I had dreamed of. You know, playing in front of, you know, 15 or 16,000 fans didn't do it for me. And I wasn't happy at the school. And so I ended up, you know, reaching back out to Coach Mason, and he brought me in with welcoming arms, and the rest is history.
Yeah, because it's always, I can't imagine the culture shock of the weather was an easy process. But let's go back a little bit further into your story. Let's go back a little bit further into your history, because I was just reading your biography, and it really struck me that you didn't come from, you know, a wealthy suburb in Dallas, and everything was always grand, and college was in my future no matter what happened. And if you didn't have the traditional lifestyle, talk to us a little bit about your lifestyle, why education is so important.
You know, I had a really unique upbringing. You know, I experienced a lot, a lot of different, you know, various demographics. Actually, my suburb, you know, it's a fairly wealthy suburb. I wouldn't call it wealthy, but it's upper middle class suburb. But, you know, my family actually lived in a small pocket of the town, predominantly African-American popular town. The majority of my family lived. And, you know, we were, you know, my great-grandfather was the first African-American in my town. And so our history runs really deep. You know, we got there back in 1896. They were sharecroppers. And so, you know, we had you know, deep roots in Grapevine, Texas. And, you know, but one unfortunate thing is that, you know, my family and the people that are around, you know, really had a lack of education. You know, both my mom and dad went to segregated, you know, elementary schools and early middle school. So, you know, they didn't, you know, education was not really a priority for them or their parents, you know. My grandparents can't read or write, you know. And so, you know, things like that really affect you, you know. I grew up around, you know, a population of people who just didn't have access to education. And they're my family, you know, the people that I, you know, look up to and love dearly. So, you know, oftentimes as a child, you know, I'd get made fun of for speaking proper, or I'd get made fun of, you know, for making good grades. It just wasn't the cool thing to do. So that's a challenging thing as a child when, you know, you're faced with the people that you're around that really are not, you know, promoting and rewarding education. So, you know, I was lucky. You know, my mom was one who was always in my corner preaching, you know, to go to school and to keep your grades up. You know, but it seemed like everyone else around me did the opposite. So that was a challenge, but it was one, I think it made me who I am. It made me, you know, into a leader. I had to take on oftentimes, you know, older cousins or people of influence around me. You know, I had to learn how to overcome and how to lead and how to lead by example, no matter what I was doing was not the cool thing. And so, you know, I give a lot, you know, to my current success to those experiences.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that, because I didn't realize that you came from essentially a suburb, but then your family was, like, say, a pocket within that. That had to even add even more difficulty to the process, in the sense that maybe you were you on the wrong side of the track or the right side of the track. Did that also come into play as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was definitely not as privileged, you know, financially as some of my friends and some of the people that, you know, I grew up around. But, you know, it also came with resources. You know, my school district was, you know, we had a good educational system. So I had the opportunity to excel if I wanted to excel. You know, I wasn't in a situation where you know, I couldn't, you know, I didn't have a quality education, because I did. And if I took advantage of that, you know, I had Division I colleges, you know, on our campus, you know, recruiting and things of that nature. So, you know, I always took school very, very seriously. You know, I took pride in my education. I took it seriously, and I tried, you know, to always to excel. You know, not only on the football field, on the track, on the baseball diamond, but also in the classroom. So, you know, I give a lot to that. You know, my coaches supported me, you know, as I got older. You know, but I had challenges, you know. I mean, I dealt with, you know, a lot of race relations, a lot of racism. You know, I dealt with, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. I dealt with, you know, skinheads. You know, I've seen and had to deal with a lot in my life, a lot of things that people probably think are foreign and think that don't happen, but, you know, they do. And, you know, and it was real for me growing up as a kid, you know, dealing with, you know, a lot of those racial issues and having to, you know, in front of, you know, the city council and lobbying the school districts to ban skinheads. And those type of things, you know, really made me who I am and kind of gave me the perspective of the world that I had.
Because talk to us a little bit about the power from within, because when you talk about a situation like that, when your family is against you, maybe the school system is against you, or is supporting more one side or the other, what are the mental thoughts that you go through to keep yourself first balanced, you know what I mean, and so you don't go off into the ditch, or you fall into just falling, hey, it's easier just to go with the crowd and just, hey, I'll just do whatever they say. How did you go through that?
You know, I live by some pretty simple sayings and some thought processes that I really try to take with me each and every day. You know, I think, you know, a person's motivation is to find their character. And so, you know, I always try to, no matter what decision I'm making or what I'm doing, I always try to do it with the right motivations. And no matter if it's personal life, business life, or whatever, you know, I always want my motivations to be pure, and my motivations to be to help the world become a better place. And I really truly believe if you live that way and you have that reflected, you know, upon your decisions that you make every day and the way that you live your life, you know, there's really nothing you can't accomplish. And so I never let those things hold me back. You know, I always saw myself, you know, in a better place. You know, I always saw myself living up to my dreams and being a huge impact on my community and being a huge impact on the world. You know, I've always seen myself, you know, as that leader who can inspire others, you know, to make the world a better place. And so, you know, I really believe it. You know, I drink my Kool-Aid, so to speak. And so, you know, I really do, you know, and it means a lot to me. And I think, you know, that has given me the ability to stay positive, no matter if there's been, you know, negative things going on in my life or things are going well. You know, I always sit back at the end of the day, I reflect on, you know, whether or not my motivations are intact. And so, you know, that's really how I make my decisions and how I continue to persevere.
So cool. So then you come up to Minnesota. You finish out your career at the collegiate level at the University of Minnesota, and then you go on to play 5 years in the NFL. Did the ideas that we're going to be talking about start? When did they kind of come into play? Was it after football? Was it during football? When did it kind of start to formalize in your mind?
As a kid. I mean, I told my mom when I was 5 or 6 years old. I seen the famine in Ethiopia, you know, watching the kids with suffering from malnutrition and pot bellies, you know, and saying that I wanted to help them, you know. I grew up in the church. I was my mom was still is strongly and deeply rooted in a Pentecostal church in the South, and so, you know, I was the choir director at 11 years old, and you know, I was very active. I played drums in the choir for the choir as well, so I was always very active in that. And you know, being a kid that was kind of a church kid, you know, I always wanted to help others and give back and, you know, and help my community. And so that really got ingrained into me at a really early age. And so, you know, I always told myself once I did, you know, get the resources or get the platform or get access to be able to really inspire others to give back to those in the most need, those who, you know, don't have, you know, opportunity, you know, like we have here in America, you know, young girls who are forced, you know, not to go to school and forced in the early marriages and early childbearing situations. You know, those vulnerable people, you know, are the people that I want to help. You know, that's what I want to dedicate my life to help and to serve, are those individuals who can't help themselves.
Interesting. So it wasn't something that came on later. It was just something that continued to grow inside, and eventually the seed became a plant or a tree or a small tree, and then became a bigger tree, and then eventually just produced the leaves and the fruit at the end of the day.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it was never about, you know, putting together a foundation. It was never about, you know, doing, you know, charity events or celebrity events to help raise awareness. That's not how it started. It just started just, you know, from a will of wanting to help and wanting to do something. And I think my life, the path of my life and the access that I've been able to have to, you know, various diplomats from various countries and being able to get exposure, you know, to very large organizations that are doing incredible work all over the world. I mean, all those things come with time. You really can't plan that out. You know, you gotta keep your motivations in line, and you just gotta, you know, really work with an open and pure heart, you know, and things will fall into place, you know, particularly when you're helping people. You know, it's contagious, and people around you want to help more, and organizations want to partner with you, and people really, you know, support you when they know what you're doing is coming from a pure place.
That's probably truer than true, I think, when you look at sometimes in the United States today. You know, there seems to be a lot of PR, you know, put out there, but there are very, very few people that actually believe or drink their own Kool-Aid, so to speak, like you mentioned earlier, because it's people do want to help. I think in America, I think there's a big gap where people have not helped for a while, or they've been thinking of themselves for a long time, and they do want to help, but there's so much, you know, distortion, you know, in that world where people don't actually believe. You know, like I'm thinking of Reggie White, you know, and all those guys that grew up you know, and you really felt that they were in. You know what I mean? Didn't make a difference whether you agreed or not. You just knew they were in.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hearing when you say that's really cool. I think that's applaudable because there's so many people that are out there just flipping their money around and really don't believe.
No, and you brought up a great person's name. I mean, Reggie White is an example of someone who, you know, he lived it and you saw it and you saw it in him and you knew he was passionate about it. And so that's what it's all about. You know, we live in a society where, you know, most people are trying to accumulate wealth and most people are trying to, you know, do whatever they can to take care of themselves and their family. You know, and it's easy to get caught up in our own bubble. You know, every one of us, even if you're rich or poor in the U.S., we live in a bubble. You know, it's not a real reflection of the world, you know, abroad. I mean, there's a billion and a half people living in extreme poverty. And, you know, there's millions and millions of orphans all over the world who, you know, are dying from diseases that we could treat, you know, for less than a dollar in our country. And so, you know, whenever you're living in a world like that, you know, it's really easy when you're in the U.S. to just ignore it because you're not faced with it front and center. So, you know, I challenge myself each and every day, you know, to remember and to reflect, you know, upon those people who don't have my opportunities. You know, when I walk into my house each and every day, the first thing that I see orphans. You know, I see babies that are suffering from malnutrition, starving. I want to see that, you know, when I start my day and when I end my day, because I want to keep that on my mind. And I think, you know, when you're constantly reminded, you know, of the truth of what the world really is, I think you have no choice but to keep balancing your life and your motivation to stay intact.
I think we should go into talking about how the mind works more so sometimes. I think this would be a fun conversation to hear because I think what I hear you saying is that you have seen the good and the bad, and I think so many in today's world need to understand that the world is not always 100% positive, and if something bad happens to you, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you did something major wrong and you're getting punished for it, whatever you want to call it. Ultimately, there is good and there's realism, you know, in surviving. So with that, I think we're going to move off to a break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about the inspiration behind your foundation. I think we've already kind of hit on it, but I think there's just a tremendous amount of information below that. So with that, we're going to a break, and after we'll be talking about Jack Brewer's foundation.
Five Star Basketball, the leader in basketball instruction and camps, endorsed by Michael Jordan, Dick Vitale, and Hubie Brown, and where the teaching never stops. Five Star Basketball Minnesota will be hosting a one-day instructional camp on May 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and will be hosted by Five Star, The McCarthy Project, and Grassroots Hoops. For more information on the camp, visit themccarthyproject.com/5-star. XL Athlete is the leading provider of online strength and conditioning and speed development camps. For more information on their training programs and speed development camps, visit xlathlete.com.
McCarthy Project, and we have been attacking life and sports since 2001. And today we have Jack Brewer on the show, and he is from Jack Brewer Worldwide, or Jack Brewer Foundation, and he has been doing some tremendous work in the world of eradicating, hopefully I get this right, eradicating poverty in the world, and he has done a tremendous amount of things. He started his own foundation, so I've asked him to kind of come on the show today to talk about his foundation and his inspiration, you know, because like you mentioned earlier in the story, I didn't realize, but he didn't have this grand plan that when he got out of college, he was going to do this, 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 and this. It was something that slowly grew. And so, Jack, give us a little bit of background on how what's the original inspiration of the foundation and how it's grown to what it is today.
Definitely. You know, our foundation, it was just really a vision of me wanting to give back, you know, the kids similar to me, kids that, you know, grew up in neighborhoods, you know, similar to mine, grew up, had parents, you know, similar to me, who may not have the means to go to college or may not have the means at getting a quality education. You know, I realized early on that everyone wouldn't be, you know, professional athletes. Some kids weren't good enough to go to college to play sports, you know, or entertainment or to get a scholarship. And so I wanted to help out those kids who didn't have that opportunity. And so starting my foundation in April of 2006, you know, we really focused on giving educational resources to students going to college. And we wanted to, you know, help them with computers or help them, you know, maybe with a little bit of extra money for their meal plan or for their books. And, you know, it was really, you know, that vision of trying to help kids that were in my shoes who may not have been able to get a full ride scholarship like I did. And so, you know, but quickly, you know, we learned that in the United States it took a lot of resources to really affect, you know, a large amount of kids. And so, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we really wanted to not only focus on the U.S., but also focus, you know, on the needs of kids globally. And, you know, I had the opportunity to speak at the African Chamber of Commerce back in 2000, late 2006, early 2007. And there I met the then ambassador to Malawi. And she, you know, she heard me speak, and we spoke after the conference. And quickly she started to tell me, you know, about the huge need in her country and about the little girls who, you know, were being deprived of education and being, you know, forced into marriages at an early age and not allowed to go to school. And so I, you know, I immediately committed to her to support them. And she told me about the programs of the current Minister of Foreign Affairs, Joyce Banda, and about her schools and orphanages and her struggles to get resources to help these little girls be able to get just access to one square meal a day and books and the basic resources that we take for granted. And so, you know, I started to support those girls, supported 10 girls, and a few months later, you know, I had the opportunity to meet Joyce Banda. She came to New York, and the government reached out to me and requested a meeting, and, you know, I was honored. And, you know, after a few minutes of sitting down with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, you know, I fell in love with her. She became, you know, my idol, my role model, and later became, you know, my second mom. And so, you know, I took a trip to Malawi a few months later to meet the little girls that I was taking care of and to kind of see everything on the ground. And I was, you know, really overwhelmed and welcomed with warm, embracing arms. The people there, you know, were living in extreme poverty, but the smiles on their faces were as big as you could imagine. And, you know, their kindness and their hearts just, you know, reflected, and it did something to me. I mean, I had tears in my eyes for hours after I landed. And so, you know, that moment, you know, changed my life. And I got a chance to go into the villages and hear the kids, you know, sing songs and see a little bit about their educational system. And, you know, after that, you know, I made a pledge. I told the Minister of Foreign Affairs that I'd be back, and I'd use every resource that I had to help, you know, bring some of these children out of extreme poverty. You know, it was a country where there's over 1.2 million orphans, you know, that have lost both parents from HIV and AIDS and other diseases. And so, you know, just watching, you know, baby starve, you know, watching, you know, a little child suffer from malnutrition, just physically starving to death, you know, it's a sight that most people have never seen, and it's one that, you know, it never leaves your mind. And so, you know, what I tried to do was just to bring my resources. You know, at the time I had just transitioned from the NFL, I was working at Merrill Lynch, and so I started to design different, you know, financial models, and we put together a microfinance program that actually helped feed over 20,000 people. And, you know, soon that grew and grew. We also, you know, also started to support some of the orphanages in the communities as well. And so just continued to, you know, project after project and really, you know, started to really get a large following from donors in the U.S. and partners in the U.S., you know, which has helped to build the foundation into what it is today.
The question I have for you is that how do – is it possible
to marry a person that's grown up in the United States to what you have seen in Malawi?
Not really. I try all the time. You know, I have, you know, friends and I have colleagues, I have teammates, former teammates, business associates, and, you know, I try to do whatever I can to bring the reality to them. You know, I try to take video and I take pictures and, you know, we do several different events. But you can never really get that experience unless you see it face to face. Living in America, it's unimaginable. You know, and pictures and videos don't do it justice. It's life-changing to really see people living in extreme poverty. It's almost unbearable. And so, you know, I take it upon myself. You know, we put together a Global Ambassador Initiative where we take, you know, athletes around the globe. We take guys usually to 4 or 5, sometimes 3, 4, 5 countries every year, Haiti, Malawi, you know, poor parts of Mexico, and other places. And we try to expose, you know, professional athletes who have resources, many of which were African-Americans who are descendants from Africa. We try to expose them to see some of the extreme poverty that really goes on in our world. And I can tell you, when each one of them gets off that plane, you know, most of them have the same reaction that I had. It's a life-changing experience for them. And so, you know, we try to bring that to the U.S., and we try to share that with all of our volunteers, all of our donors, and everyone involved in JBF.
And I have actually another question. How do you think that you had mentioned that you see uprightness in their face, you know, when you go there, but they're in a very difficult circumstance? How do they maintain that positive outlook or that happiness, you think?
Well, you know, I've traveled a lot of places in Africa, you know, and I've seen a lot of cultures. And I tell people this all the time. I've never experienced a people as pure as Malawians. You know, Malawi is known as the warm heart of Africa. And it's something that's rare about them. You know, it's a place that's never had a civil war. You know, they've never had a major war in their country. You know, it's a place where, you know, most of the police officers don't even carry guns. And so, you know, it's a unique situation, and it's like nothing else I've ever experienced. And I've been, you know, through South America, all through Latin America, you know, Europe. I've been a lot of places. I've been blessed in a sense that I've been able to travel quite a bit. But, you know, I've never seen a people as pure as them, as happy and joyous, and they appreciate the small things. And I think, you know, I think it's just in them. And you know, for a country that's so poor, the people are so rich. And it's really inspirational to see.
Amazing. And then another question around the inspiration. Do you see the inspiration changing? Is there a bigger vision for the foundation, or is it just a continuance? I shouldn't say just, but a continuance of the same, just helping people on the ground.
Yeah, I think, you know, at our core, you know, we want to empower from within. I think we do it in different ways than most. You know, we built a model where we have all volunteers. We have no staff in the U.S. You know, I use all of my corporate staff. They volunteer their time. So our foundation, no money really goes to the overhead of staffing and employees. You know, only thing it goes to is administrative costs and helping the people. And so, you know, we're lucky in that sense, and I think, you know, our foundation has grown and momentum has continued to pick up. Our model is different. You know, we partner with organizations. We don't go in the ground. When we say empowering from within, we don't go on the ground and implement our own programs. You know, we don't go, you know, in a poor country and tell the people what they need to do. Because in most countries that are in extreme poverty, the elders and those individuals, the teachers and the people in the community, they know what they need. They know how to get themselves out of extreme poverty. They just need resources. You know, they may need some creativity and some advice, but at its core, they don't need anyone to come in and implement, you know, their own programs and strategies. They truly need to be empowered from within. And that's the reason why, you know, we took that on as a slogan. You know, I learned that on my first trip to Africa. And after that, you know, that's when we implemented that slogan. You know, I just got an understanding and I saw, you know, how many intelligent people were there.
And so I wanted to support them. And so what we do is we find resources and we find partnerships and we find different aid organizations that we can bring to the communities that we help serve. And we can help those communities empower themselves. So that's our philosophy.
I think that's great because so much in history, and I'm just using that as a broad swipe, but I don't know how to put this. United States tend to go out there with the big bumper, you know, the big hammer, and say, you know, by the way, you're doing it my way, and here's your resources, you know, type of a scenario, rather than like the model you're talking about, which I think would be tremendously more effective for the people in where you're going, is that you're not going out there to thump on them and say you're doing it wrong. You're going out there and say, here, we're here to help. Here's some resources. How do you want to do it? I think it's fascinating.
Again, what's your motivation? Your motivation to empower, or is your motivation to just deliver aid? You see, you know, sending a country blind aid doesn't do it any justice. It really, because once the aid stops, the people can't empower themselves. So sustainability is key. Sustainability is number one. And, you know, a lot of foundations are learning that. You know, a lot of the larger organizations are learning that. You know, and our policies are changing. Even if you look at the U.S. government, you know, USAID, which is one of our largest aid organizations in our government where we send billions of dollars of aid, even we're changing our philosophy. You know, we're not just dumping aid anymore. And, you know, people are learning. You know, there's a lot of people living in extreme poverty, but, you know, just like I read in the article this week in The Economist, you know, there's been over a billion people that have come out of extreme poverty. You know, over the last 30 years. And in the next 30 years, you know, there should be another billion more to come out of extreme poverty. So we are making progress. The world itself is opening its eyes. You know, when the United Nations put together the Millennium Development Goals, I mean, that was huge. You know, countries are now getting awarded and being recognized for making strides toward ending extreme poverty and taking on issues, you know, like climate change and taking on issues prenatal issues and medical issues that are dealing with young children and women. You know, these issues are front and center. You know, clean water, you know, access to food and food security. You know, those things matter now on a global scale. I think we need to do a better job in the U.S. of educating our children about those issues. You know, instead of just educating our kids on, you know, U.S. policies and U.S., you know, government relations, we need to broaden it up, you know, and teach our kids, you know, what the U.N. really means and what the United Nations stands for and why, you know, we live in a global society. And so those are all issues and things that, you know, as a foundation, you know, we take on. You know, our educational initiatives, you know, our Montessori Model United Nations issues, you know, we take on these type of initiatives because these are the ones that matter, and we always try to keep a global view, you know, with everything that we do.
Done. All right, we're going to go to a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about your event that's going to be coming up here in a couple weeks. And so we'll be right back after the break.
Five Star Basketball, the leader in basketball instruction and camps, endorsed by Michael Jordan, Dick Vitale, and Hubie Brown, and where the teaching never stops. Five Star Basketball Minnesota will be hosting a one-day instructional camp on May 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and will be hosted by Five Star, The McCarthy Project, and Grassroots Hoops. For more information on the camp, visit themccarthyproject.com/5-star. XL Athlete is the leading provider of online strength and conditioning and speed development camps. For more information on their training programs and speed development camps, visit xlathlete.com.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully you enjoyed that time with Jack. Unfortunately, due to time commitments, we are not going to be able to air the third and final segment of the show, but we will be re-airing the interview on Sunday night at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. And he talks about the celebrity event he's been putting on. He's doing some stuff with concussions. It really is a great event. He's going to be packing meals for people over in Malawi. He's looking for volunteers. If you are interested in supporting Jack, please give him or touch base with him at jackbrewer.net. Now, that has all of his history. It has what he's doing as far as he has got a financial services company, as well as Jack Brewer Foundation Worldwide. He's doing a lot of really cool stuff. So from that standpoint, it's jackbrewer.net, and you can touch base with him. I apologize that we're not able to finish up the interview, but we will be re-airing it specifically without commercials and on Sunday evening, 7 p.m. Central Time. Just look for it on our channel and on our website. Thank you very much, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Again, thank you, everybody, for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed Sean and Jack today. I think both of them really have a deep understanding of what they're doing and would love to support their organizations in any way we can. Thanks. And also one other thing, if you're interested in getting a hold of myself, we have some great training services in the area of performance enhancement and strength development. Visit us at themccarthyproject.com. That's the McCarthy Project, all spelled out. Thanks, and talk to you next week.